Good evening and welcome to another episode of Cheater and the Rude on PRN. I am Jeff Kreisler, author of the book Get Rich Cheating, and tonight I want to talk about something near and dear to my heart, and that is the ability to speak truth to power. One of the main benefits of satire, of comedy, when used by masters of the craft. And I want to talk about it because I think we're at a turning point in our democracy after the McCutcheon decision this week, which my listeners I'm sure know was the one that basically said that, or reaffirmed that money is speech and gave no ability to sort of control campaign contributions and basically sold off our democracy to people with the money that are able to buy it. That if our elections and if our courts and if our legislatures are no longer people who we can trust to protect our interests, or rather to even speak about our interests honestly and perceptively and with a goal that is not driven by personal gain, but rather simply education and enlightenment and moving things forward, then it may fall to the comedians, to the satirists, who I realize have to pay their bills too, so I need a sponsor. Sad. But, you know, the legacy of comedy and satire, what drew me into it and what drew Lee Pop of the Rude Pundit into it, was the ability to cut through the chase, cut to the chase, cut through the BS. And I want to talk about one of the great moments in the history of satire speaking truth to power, and that was when Lenny Bruce was arrested and he had a trial. And I want to relay that story through the eyes of my partner in the other show that I have, the Final Edition Radio Hour, Tony Hendra, who had the distinct pleasure of opening for Lenny Bruce in New York City on the weekend that he was arrested. So sit back and listen to us chat about that great moment in satire history and, in fact, American history.
After the smashing success of our discussion last week about the 30th anniversary of Spinal Tap, we have decided we will continue what is now a series of conversations about comedy and history and satire and its place in the world between myself, Jeff Kreisler, and Tony Hendra. I was thinking maybe we could call this Talking with Tony.
Talking with Tony, yeah. Hey. Why not?
Hey. Actually, hearing you do that makes me want to force you to talk for 15 minutes in that accent. And then I'll do some sort of weird British.
Sure.
All right. We're not going to call it Talking with Tony, but we are going to discuss with Anthony Hendra.
I'm not Anthony or Anthony. Only my mother calls me Anthony. And she's dead now these many years. And Anthony, it's just impossible. That's what my grandmother used to call me, who I detested. And every time she called me Anthony, she would spit on her hanky and wipe a little smudge off my cheek.
So as you can see, this is not just for comedy fans, but also for psychotherapy fans who would like to analyze the depths of a comedian's soul.
$25 a visit.
Is that all we're charging these days?
I was just watching Jackie Mason from 1961. So.
Wow, you did an amazing range of voices. We should just cut those up.
Okay, stop, please.
So, Tony, last week, or actually this whole year, is the 30th anniversary of this release of Spinal Tap. And as some of our listeners may know, you have accomplished many things in your comedy career, of which we can either be jealous or sad. And I was just wondering, you mentioned a couple other anniversaries.
Or regretful.
Well, you can be regretful. I will just laugh.
I think some people regret some of the things I've done, certainly. Anyway, yes, it's true that it's the 30th anniversary of Spinal Tap this year, but it is, in fact, this very week, in fact, the 23rd of March, which was last Sunday, was the 50th anniversary of my landing on these shores.
Hmm.
I actually arrived at, I think it was Pier 81 or somewhere, something like that, in the SS United States, which was a liner, the supposedly the fastest ocean-going liner that plied the Atlantic route.
It was the Titanic of the 60s.
It was the Titanic of the early 60s, yes. And actually, it was first built, I think, in the early 50s. But anyway, it was...
Was it a wooden boat?
It was not a wooden boat, no. Mm. It was a metal boat.
Mm.
But it was a very large and shiny boat. And I, when we first, well, we, meaning me and my partner, at that time I was, let me start again, arrived in these shorts. And at the time, I was fairly fresh out of Cambridge, where I'd been in the footlights with amongst others, John Cleese and Graham Chapman.
We will have, for those of you listening, if you go online, you can Google what all these things are. You should know what they all are, but just in case.
You certainly should know what John Cleese and Graham Chapman
were.
Yes.
Cambridge
but,
also.
But in any event, so I was a sort of dyed-in-the-wool proto-satirist at that point, and I had a partner in those days who, a guy called Nick Ullett, and we had established a little reputation for ourselves in London after coming down from Cambridge, and one of the places we played was called the Blue Angel. And the Blue Angel was a rather pucker nightclub off Berkeley Square.
In London.
In London. And not Berkeley Square, Berkeley Square, but that's how it's spelt. And one of the headliners who was booked in the Blue Angel off Berkeley Square was Jackie Mason. Jackie Mason was at that time himself not very far out of his rabbinical school, having decided to become a comedian instead of a rabbi.
Seems to be a common thread, at least amongst
yes,
a couple
indeed.
People.
And I love Jackie. I thought he was just amazing. He had this kind of machine gun delivery and a very nice line in sort of upside down logic, which appealed to my philosophically trained brain. And anyway, the important thing was he really took shine to us too. He thought Nick and I were very funny and very British, as you said. British, you're very British. And he had a manager whose name was Bob or Robert Chartoff, who would later go on to many wonderful things, such as producing Rocky 1 through 28. And Bob not only liked us, but he said in the course of one of the he said, if you ever want to come to New York, I will take you under my wing and manage you. And who knows? This was obviously in the early months of 1964,
right,
when the Beatles had just crashed into national,
sure,
if not
they
global
were looking for the next Beatles, and
right,
you
and,
were the best they
and,
could
and,
be.
And what Bob actually said, he said, if you come to New York, I will make you, who knows, he said, he didn't say I will make it, say this again, he said, I will manage you, and who knows, you might become the Beatles of comedy.
That's great.
And that was a very nice, crisp little slogan to live on. So a couple of months later, or actually about 6 weeks later, we decided to give this a whirl because we were getting very bored with the Blue Angel off Berkeley Square. And at that time, you could get a first-class stateroom on an ocean-going liner from Southampton to New York if you agreed to do a show for the passengers.
Yeah.
Well, just one show in the course of a four and a half
the
day.
The original
crossing.
Cruise ship gig.
Indeed. Indeed. And so we thought that was pretty great. And we got our first-class stateroom and sailed from Southampton in late March of 1964. And as we found out later from the crew, it was the worst crossing that anyone could remember.
Hmm.
So bad, in fact, that the entire complement of 800 passengers got violently seasick, except for me. And Nick.
This is from the ships tossing the sail, or the cruise itself was.
And the SS United States, by the way, had special trimmers, I think they were called, which were supposed to control, you know, pitching and yawing. But despite them, it was a hideous crossing, and so we never had to do our show, which was a very nice introduction to the United States. So anyway, on the morning of March the 23rd, 1964, after a Scotch-fueled evening and night, staying up to see the Statue of Liberty
preparing
rise.
To welcome America.
Indeed.
As she welcomed you.
Indeed. Seeing the Statue of Liberty rise out of the polluted mist of New York Harbor.
It's very clean now, by the way.
Very clean. And I must say, Liberty was a little bit of a disappointment, but I didn't see her entire body, just her head and the crown, basically. But we actually docked and got out and were admitted to the greatest city in the world. And within,
do you think that part of your development as a satirist has to do with the fact that you just saw clouded Liberty?
Yes, that's actually a very good point. That image, that image has that image has indeed stayed with me. I see liberty as through a polluted mist.
I
unclear.
That is your album cover. Liberty, your next album cover.
Liberty is opaque to me. but in any event, it. Bob,
so you landed, you got off.
We got off the boat, and we went to Bob's... Bob's partner, by the way, was a guy called Erwin Winkler, who later went to even greater filmic glory. So Charter Winkler had offices on West 57th Street, and we crashed into them and went to sleep. And by the time we'd woken up, Bob had arranged for us to appear at a Hootenanny. And a Hootenanny was kind of like, the best way to describe it is it was a kind of American idol for folk singers and mimes and other entertainers.
When I first got to New York, there was the alt scene at the time, back in the end of the 90s, I guess. There was a great show. It was called the Hootenanny. It was a Sunday night, and it was a variety show in what I consider true New York style, from fire eaters and strippers to comedians and just acts I can't even describe.
Well,
I don't know if that's what you had. But.
Yes, I mean, in the Hootenanny at that time really meant kind of the folky fringe, and comedians who aspired to that, which were not, there were not very many of them, but and it took place at a place called the Bitter End, the legendary Bitter End. So at the time, we were Nick and I were doing. Still doing our kind of footlightsy Cambridge twittering kind of British satire. And it was pieces like this.
We'd like to sing you now, quite seriously, one of the most beautiful lyrics ever written in the English language. What else could I mean but Wordsworth's very famous poem, To the Daffodils. I'm on the lonely as a cloud that floats as high up in the clouds. Well, once I saw around a host of golden daffodils beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze.
Or this.
Good evening. Here is the news. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Here are the news. It was announced this morning that unless Britain's debt to the International Monetary Fund is not discharged by the end of the month, the government will be forced to accept the American government's generous offer of $500 million and sell the Queen.
Okay.
And, again, everyone can imagine the great comedy twitterings of of the lovebirds. Well, did you guys have a name, by the way, or was it just Hendren Ulrich?
Hendren Ullett.
Ullett. Thank you.
That was his name. He. It was Ullett and Hendren. He was the one behind the mic. What?
I'm pantomiming to you that we have 5 minutes left.
Oh, we're going
to
cut masses.
Oh, I understand. Sure. I just wanted to make sure everyone listening knew that.
Anyway, so we went on with this kind of material at the bitter end, and for completely unexplained reasons, brought the house down. And
it's just like that for every comedian.
This
gig, Jackie Mason brings you over to New Country. First gig, you kill it. Perfect. Hate you so
much. We kill. And as it happened, we never killed again for quite some time. But based on this act of mass murder, we actually got like 6 months of work because it was. So we were right then and there after like a day in New York. We were hot in New York. It was fantastic. And the first job, the first booking we got, or the first booking we accepted, was at a very new place called the Café Ogogo, which had just opened across Bleecker Street. And the owner, Howie Solomon, wanted us to open for his first big comedy act, who was Lenny Bruce.
Nice.
So Hendra and Ollett actually opened for Lenny Bruce at his legendary gig, which in April of 1964.
That's when bad things happen around then.
Yes, indeed. And we were Lenny idols. I mean, it was just we didn't know very much about American comedians, but Lenny had been was notorious in England because he'd come a couple of times to England and played.
Well, you can't be a comedian and have some element of satire at that era without.
Obeisance to Lenny
people,
Bruce.
People that are more in tune with more recent era, I would think he has a presence like Bill Hicks probably had a presence in the UK in his moment. I mean, it's not a complete comparison, but from everything I've gathered, Bill Hicks had a moment where he was sort of hugely idolized in the UK, and so did, I think, Bruce probably everywhere at that time.
Well, but I think that sort of exchange is very accurate. So we were... you know, there we were opening for Lenny Bruce, and we sort of knew all his routines. So we were sitting there on the edge of the stage, literally at his feet, sopping up this fantastic satire. And although many people who've written about this gig, because as will unfold, it was a particularly notorious one, which basically ended Lenny's career. Have said that Lenny was already in decline at that point, but I didn't think so at all, and I knew his material fairly well. But he did this sort of wonderful, seemed to me like almost like a victory lap, where he was certainly doing his well known material, such as this.
Ladies are one emotion, and guys detach, not consciously detach, but they just do detach. Like a lady can't go through a plate glass window and go to bed with you 5 seconds later. But guys can have head-on collisions with Greyhound buses in disaster areas. Everybody's laying dead on the highway. Not only the hospital and the ambulance, the guy makes play for the nurse. Like, how could he do a thing at a time like that? Well, I got horny. For what? You're hot. How could you be hot when your foot was cut off and you're dead? I don't know. He's an animal. He got hot with his foot cut off. I guess I'm an animal. I don't know. Okay. What did you get hot at? The nurse's uniform. It's a moron, that's all. He's just an animal. No, it's guys detach and has nothing to do with them liking, loving. You put guys in a desert island, they'll do it to mud. Mud.
And, of course, the wonderful...
Christ and Moses are both... possessed humility. Why? Wisdom. That's it. Anybody who is secure, there's never any hostility, because he's cool. So they just stand on the back of St. Patrick's. And they listen, look at him. Cardinal Spellman would be relating love and giving and forgiveness to the people, and Christ would be confused, because their route took him through Spanish Harlem. And he would wonder what 40 Puerto Ricans were doing living in one room. This guy had a ring on it, was worth $8,000. And he would wonder at the grandeur. See, weren't the Puerto Ricans living here? It's clean and nice. And maybe Bishop Sheen would see them back there and run up to Spellman on the lectern. Psst, I want to talk to you for a minute. What is it? What is it? You'll never guess who's here. Who's here? You're not going to believe me. You're going to think I've been drinking. All right, who's here? Christ and Moses. Are you sure it's them? Well, I've just seen them in pictures, but I'm pretty sure it's them. Moses is a ringer for Charlton Heston, and I'm sure. They're back here, yes. All right, it's only... If this ever gets around now... It has. Oh, Christ, don't look in the front door. The lepers are coming.
Love those.
And no doubt, as a result of this extraordinary victory lap that he was taking, he was busted 2 days into the gig as he came off stage by four NYPD detectives.
So was those? I mean, I knew around then that was the gig.
That was the gig, huh. And he was busted for obscenity, but as I sort of figured out later, it wasn't really obscenity that Lenny was busted for. This is a whole other discussion, obviously, but it's my theory, which I expounded at some length in my book, Going Too Far, that Lenny was never really busted for obscenity. Lenny was busted for being very rude about Catholicism. And since the big cities in which he played, notably San Francisco, Chicago, and New York City, had police departments which were 90% Catholics. Irish,
yeah.
And or Italian, and therefore Catholic, did not go down so well. And I think that's one of the reasons he was repeatedly busted in these places.
I completely agree. I always thought it was more blasphemy than obscenity. Was
indeed.
And subversive blasphemy. If you have a power structure in many of these cities that, A, the police force is Catholic, and, B, I mean, even still in New York, Cardinal whatever his name has unwieldy power, I would think that would be considered
Cardinal
a threat.
Dolan. His name is Dolan.
Thank you.
Or as we call him, Roly-Poly Dolan.
I wanted to say Dolan, but isn't the owner of the Knicks also Dolan? He's also terrible.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere.
Jerks.
But
anyway.
As one little addition to that, the one of the few new pieces that Lenny was doing at that time in his routine was about the assassination, and he had a bug in his head about a Life magazine article, which had shown Jackie. It's a very famous picture. Jackie sort of crawling off the back of the Lincoln, and Life captioned this obvious moment of fear and trembling on the First Lady's part as the First Lady going for help. This was the caption that they mm-hmm. applied to that particular photo, which obviously on the face of it was absurd, but...
help was coming.
But help was standing on the side. It was standing on the running board.
Right.
But Lenny really, really took exception to this, and what he said was, no, she was not going for help. She was hauling ass to save ass. And that went down, I mean, especially with the newly canonized Saint Jackie, the poor grieving widow.
A bit of a thud.
That did not go down at all well with the boys in blue. And I'm quite convinced that that's basically why he was busted. Because when he came back, having been bailed out to do the second week of his gig, he did the same thing and was busted again. And in the subsequent trial, of all the charges against him, there were actually 10 charges of obscenity against him, 9 of which were using words like, you know, cocksucker and doing it with mud and...
does that mean drinking coffee?
Eleanor,
crosswords.
Yeah, well, I mean, but the Eleanor Roosevelt's tits, you know,
yeah.
This kind of stuff.
Let me ask.
But let me just finish this.
Yeah, you finish, then I'll ask.
Because he, the tenth one of them was that he said, and the First Lady was hauling ass to save ass. She wasn't going for help.
So they would say that ass was the obscenity when really it was the imagery.
Ass. I mean,
right.
You know,
donkeys. So did you two open for him just one night? Was it that whole first set of shows? Did he do it again?
Oh, no, we opened for it. We were his opening act.
I mean, for the New York
There run. Was nobody who less needed an opening act than Lenny.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But we figured out very quickly that our main function was to sort of keep the Lenny files, get the Lenny files quieted
right.
down. And
how did you sense, I mean, having opened myself a few times for giant names, that are there and everyone's there to see them, it's sometimes that is sort of your job, is to get their focus. Did you though get any notable response? Did you, like, creatively, did you grow from working his audience besides sort of being in his presence? I realize, you know, that was just a few gigs, but anything?
Not remotely.
Okay.
We did our twittering English satire to dead silence.
Okay.
But we didn't care that we were bombing.
Right. Let me ask you, what is your comedy partner? What happened with him?
Well, we had subsequently, but I'll get into this at
another time. Let's talk about your comedy partnership another time.
Okay.
Do you?
I mean, obviously, this was an extraordinary adventure to have had within 3 weeks of landing in the United States, and it taught us that obviously it was very. Very easy, or apparently very easy, to become hot in New York.
Yeah.
And it was just as easy to get busted for being too funny.
Well, it sounds...
So these were mixed messages. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Well, it also, it's like a three-week it sounds like what Hollywood would make out of the journey of a comedian or a comedy duo that you know you picked up by Jackie Mason, you get on a boat that is all a terrible, you know, you guys would probably be scared on the boat ride in the movie. You land at the shores with Cloud of Liberty.
Yeah, one of us would throw up.
Yeah, right, one of you throw up.
Which was accurate. Nick threw up. I didn't.
Well, good. That guy's a throw-up jerk. Cloud of Liberty, you show up, you do one gig, next thing you know, you're opening for Lenny Bruce and his famous thing. Like, Hollywood would make that all happen in 3 weeks. In reality, that happens over the course of 3 or 10 years, and you actually did it in 3 weeks.
We actually did it in 3 weeks.
Right, so.
And the kicker to this, obviously, was that this particular bust, which did, in fact, end up destroying Lenny's career, because the entire Irish judicial establishment came after him from the DA, the Manhattan DA, who's a thug called Frank Hogan. It at the time it was it was Dirty Mouth Lenny in the Daily News on the front page, and when you opened the story and went inside, there was Hendra and Ullett, who had been opening for him. So all that work we got off our one extraordinarily puzzling
ovation. Maybe there was a soccer or football tournament happening at the time of your first gig, and so you had a bunch of expats and that. Hey, whatever it takes to get in the paper 50 years ago.
It baffles analysis.
Yeah. Well, this has been another Talk with Tony.
Thank you.
Discussion with Tony Hendra about some comedy stuff. We're going to keep doing this now and then, because I think we found that our fans are also fans of comedy history, and stick around for more.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Cheater and the Rude on Progressive Radio Network. Check out me, Jeff Kreisler. That's JeffKreisler at JeffKreisler.com or Twitter, Jeff Kreisler. And keep being awesome. Good luck, everybody.